Welcome to Grumpy Strategists, episode 47. I'm your host, Michael Shoopridge, and I'm joined again by SAA's head of research, Dr. Marcus Hellyer.
Hello.
From Alaska, but on his way to Samoa.
It's a hard life, Michael, this semi-retired gig. It's quite taxing, but I'm always happy to make time to come in here and have a grump and share our thoughts with our listeners.
Well, there's no point talking about the Indo-Pacific if you're not traveling the Indo-Pacific and eyeballing that great expanse of ocean and the creatures and humans that populate it. So well done. You're not head of research for nothing, Marcus.
I'm going to ground truth the facts on the ground in Samoa.
Well, interestingly, ground truthing some facts on the ground is what this episode is about. We've got Minister Conroy's breathless article in last week's Australian newspaper saying critics that say the Australian Defence Force isn't right up to speed with drones are wrong because we've got lots of them. I think he listed 8 different kinds, and he said, and we've got armed drones.
Okay, so you've ground-truthed the critics and they're wrong?
No, Mr. Conroy is probably on the verge of gilding the lily. Quite a lot of gild on the lily. More gild than lily. So, yes, the ADF does have one armed drone at the moment. The Switchblade 300.
Remember that announcement? This was one that actually was provided to the Ukrainians early on in the war, but my understanding is it's kind of fallen a bit out of favour, partly just because of cost and the effect you get out of it. You can essentially get out of the cheap and cheerful quadcopter type drone. So nice if you've got them, but you're just never going to have them at scale.
Yeah, well, they're a US-made drone, but the US Army, back in April 2023, said they weren't going to buy any more of them. And I think it was because of this experience out of Ukraine and their cost. That is the loitering munition that the ADF has.
So we have one, but, okay, bit too expensive. So, but aren't we pumping money into the Australian drone ecosystem?
Well, yes, potentially. There's a request for tender out for medium-range loitering munitions out of ASCA, that accelerator that so far hasn't actually resulted in anything coming into the Defence Force.
Right, but we've changed our approach with ASCA, new head in, much more sort of warfighter-focused, yes, so there is an approach to market out, but that would imply it's not actually in service yet.
Well, not in service. And with ASCA, there's always that question about are any of the services actually interested in anything that ASCA funds and proves? And is there a capability budget? Or is it more of this performance by grant and demonstrator thing that we've seen before?
Well, how much money are we talking about here?
Well, I didn't see the money for Talon Strike. I saw the money for their counter drone proposal, which again was breathlessly announced to say Australia's all in on counter drone systems. We'll have 120 counter drone systems, but the actual money is $16.7 million for 11 Australian companies, and $5 million is going to one company, a very capable company, Drone Shield. So 10 other companies are going to share about $11 million. That just is not enough to do anything beyond demonstrations.
So what you seem to be saying is of this $10 billion for drones that the government keeps pointing to in the integrated investment program over the decade, we are still in kind of the trickle feed or drip feed stage, not really in the mass production stage.
Well, particularly as we're mainly buying from US suppliers with stuff that the ADF actually has now. That's things like the Black Hornet, the Wasp, the Switchblade. There's a Brisbane company, Quantum Vector, which is making the two-in-one, you know, a fixed-wing quadcopter.
Is this one of those cool swivelly ones it moves from vertical launch
to off
horizontal
and then
flight?
Fixed-wing for flight. And that looks like
so
it's an ISR.
A mini V-22 Osprey.
Yeah. So that's good. There's SciPac with their Corvo X, which is not the cardboard drone. So that's two Australian companies, but they're both ISR, so surveillance, not armed. Then there's the R-70 Sky Ranger, which is a Canadian quadcopter. That could carry something. It's about 5 kilograms of quadcopter, about $87,000 each, which is quite expensive. But no Baba Yaga, you know, the sort of bomber quadcopter the Ukrainians have. We've mainly got small, overseas-produced surveillance drones.
So I guess my take on this is, yes, okay, this is good. We're starting to see the first kind of green shoots of a kind of drone ecosystem.
In a frosty, frosty land.
in Australia. Yep. But ultimately, early days on the new ASCA. But when I sort of look at the new ASCA and I look at the paperwork requirements, so when they go out to market, it does still look like a kind of slimmed down version of the traditional defence acquisition process. And when ASCA puts out an ATM, an approach to market, the goal is still a product,
yep.
Right? So we're not sort of creating, in my view, an ecosystem, you know, and I know
or a production
the rules
chain.
Of the game are when somebody says ecosystem, we all drink because it's such a cliche. Yep.
But there's no production system.
So when I look at this and I compare it to, say, the Ukrainians, you know, we're not there yet, and I'm not sure how we get there from where we are now, because we are still in that situation where we're in the traditional defence monopoly monopsony position. So we've spoken about this before, where defence has a monopoly on the provision of defence security services to the government, and it also is a monopsony consumer of defence goods and services from industry. So defence is the bottleneck. And the challenge always for militaries in peacetime is how do you break out of that situation where defence is the bottleneck? How do you inject competition into it? You know, one of the things we're seeing in Ukraine is actually you inject competition, well, first of all, by an arsehole like Vladimir Putin invading your country.
Yep.
But then when you respond to it, what we're seeing is they're delegating responsibility downwards, not just for operating in the field, but buying stuff, testing stuff, producing stuff. And I would like to see more downwards delegation. You know, give the COs of battalions, here's $10 million, knock yourself out, invent a whole new drone concept for us. You know?
And show it to me. Well, Steve Baxter and I talked about that in the Makers Series episode. He was talking about the Ukrainian Brave One model, which is exactly that. Yeah, and at the moment, it's buying small penny packets of individual things that it's not leading to a production capacity behind them. I mean, hopefully with Quantum Vector and SciPak, maybe that's the start of something. But celebrating this tiny little set of initiatives, which has a bunch of obsolete things, and pretending that defence is anywhere near up to speed, I think that's deceptive. And Minister Conroy needs to get a better briefing from his department.
Well, the other, in Minister Conroy's defence, more money is being spent in this space. I know about this because of my professional connections. More money is going into the drone space, but defence doesn't really talk about it. And they're sort of pathologically opposed to sort of getting out good news because they're so obsessed with security and everything is now governed by national security and we can't release that kind of stuff. So a lot of the good news isn't getting out there, but I would agree we are still not in the space where Australian companies are getting commercial scale contracts to actually produce this stuff. And I think the number you just said, $11 million in this latest announcement of R&D drip feed once you take out the drone shield money. Well, why is that an interesting number? Well, because that's about what the AUKUS SSN program is spending per day.
Yes.
So we're now over $3 billion a year for Australia's SSN program. So that works out at about 10 or 11 million a day.
So that really is why I found drilling in behind Conroy's announcement to be so offensive, because the scale of what's being done is not a rounding error. When you look at the huge amounts of cash out of the defence budget that's going already on AUKUS and the Hunter frigate. So that to me is a measure that says this is not a serious effort. And the fact that he had to cobble together drones that were bought back in 2014, ones that even the US Army doesn't think are good enough. And there was a very amusing announcement out of the US Army that was rapidly deleted from social media, where it was what looked like a commercial
I've actually got, there's this great article here, again, on the Warzone website.
Yeah.
We refer to their stuff quite a lot because they're very bloody
good
and write great stuff. So, yes, the US Army, according to this piece, posted on social media this breathless piece saying, "Have you ever seen a drone drop a grenade?" As if this was some amazing new technology. Well, actually, we have. It was 10 years ago when ISIS was using drones to drop grenades on The US military and on the Iraqi military in places like
Mosul. I remember that. And the ISIS gaffer taped drone on the commercial quadcopter looked very like the one in this US Army celebration this year. And it was only 10 years ago. So call me a skeptic about this idea we should be fast followers of the Americans with everything. But 10 years behind ISIS is not a good place to be.
Yes. Well, all right. Some good news in Australian military capability space, some hopefully good news, is that at Talisman Sabre 25, we test-fired PrSM, so the Precision Strike Missile, so the next missile that's going to go on the HIMARS launches, which yep. we're getting into service. I will editorialise a bit and say, while this is a good thing, it essentially, in my view, means we're just catching up to the industry standard in this space. After a long delay, we are moving from towed tube artillery finally into something with some yeah. real meaningful range. So PrSM Increment 1, I believe, has a range of about 500 kilometres.
Okay. Look, let me just ask one thing about
PrSM. Go ahead, Michael.
What's the production looking like with PrSM? Because I am a bit tired of people celebrating the performance specifications of individual things and then not noticing that, well, even if you love them, you can't have them, or they're so expensive you can buy three, which is a problem that defence is replete with. So they always celebrate, well, look at this magical new thing we just fired. I don't have any in my inventory, and the US production system is going to produce them all for themselves for the next 30 years.
But you're such a cynic, but we have actually seen this with SM-6 and Tomahawk land attack missiles, where we've said we've test-fired them, woohoo, but we probably don't have any. Well, I'm glad you asked about PrSM, because I actually
did
some ground truthing, so I've gone to the US budget documentation for FY. PrSM, yeah, unfortunately, the US's production has decreased from 250 in 2025 to only 152 in 2026. And that's even getting to 152 required a huge top-up through the US budget reconciliation process.
The Republican kick-in on the front.
Yeah, that we've seen so much about in the media. The US Army's target for PrSM is to acquire 5,575 PrSM, so about 5,500. Mm-hmm. So if you are producing 152 a year, it's going to take them approximately 36 years and 8 months to hit that target.
Okay, but that's good, because they will have topped up their own stockpile at about the same time we get our 8th AUKUS submarine. So we, together with our American partners, will be armed to the teeth in the 2050s. It's ready to confront resolutely any threat. And in fact, after that 36 years of PrSM production for US purposes, we could be first in the queue. So I think if we act now, we could be pretty early on in the late 2050s for getting PrSM deliveries.
Yeah, look, I'm not sure in that 5,575 number whether that includes orders for US partners and allies, of which there is sort of an growing number of people who have now acquired the HIMARS systems, and where we sit in that, I'm not quite sure. We did sign up a year or two ago
to a development program.
Yeah. Hopefully we're towards the top of the list.
You're thinking maybe the late 2040s. that feels a bit racy, but that is certainly good news. And look, the numbers aren't important, Marcus. You know, it has under Project CA 49, which is the main surveillance drone program. Last year we had 700 drones. No, I don't mean 700 types of drones. I mean 700 individual drones. The fact that the Russians are launching 800 Shahids against Ukraine every night might put that number in perspective. So when I hear a number of 5,500 elegant new missiles, I think about a war, and that what's that song? That don't impress me much.
Well, I'm also sort of not sure how many we think we're going to get, because the unit price for PrSM seems to be about 1.7-ish US million. So that's about 2.7 Aussie million. Mm-hmm. So I'm not quite sure how many of them we're going to get. So, but the other thing about Talisman Sabre, so let's move from the stuff themselves, the technology itself, to how it's used.
And, yep.
I will say that every time we sort of criticise defence in its slow uptake of drones, the response seems to be, well, don't obsess about the actual technology or don't obsess about the system. Mm. It's how you use it that's important.
Mm. It's
how you integrate it. And, and so I would love to, so there's been, you know, endless media releases out of Talisman Sabre. You know, fine, that's good. It's nice to see what's going on. What I don't really have a good sense of is how integrated drone technology is into the ADF and counter-drone technology is into the ADF. But I suspect if you don't actually have a lot of the drones, it's hard to really work on integrating it into your operating concepts.
Well, it'd be nice to hear something like the exercise involves our simulated adversary using all the stuff that we fear they might use, which includes that traditional technology that we're familiar with, but also everything that the Houthis, the Israelis, the Russians and the Ukrainians have been throwing at each other. Could be quite disturbing. Like, give special forces a free hand and see whether they come up with some stuff like we've seen out of the Ukrainians and the Israelis, you know, striking deep at core military systems with a combination of sneaky people and cheap drones.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know that as we refight the Battle of Shoalwater Bay again. What are the ground rules there? Like, is the ADF operating on the assumption that they are going to be, you know, operating under this constant presence of drones above them? So, I don't know.
Yeah. Is that a dugong or is it a spear tooth?
But to pick up on sort of one of those announcements about the use of PRISM and HIMARS, you know, apparently one of the mini exercises that was done was to fly HIMARS launches into Christmas Island and launch HIMARS out of Christmas Island. And you go, well, that's a good thing. But it gets back to this point of we do seem to be kind of replicating where the US Marine Corps has gone and increasingly the US Army in the Pacific is going. And that is in this kind of mirroring of the Chinese A2 AD strategy, their
anti-access area
denial strategy. Yep. So the Chinese developed this to try and stop the US breaking in to support Taiwan in the case of a conflict over Taiwan. Now the US is kind of mirroring and saying, well, we're going to stop you breaking out past the first island chain. We're going to fly US Marine Corps missiles into islands and we'll sink your ships using truck-launched missiles.
Little choke points, small forces moving around quickly.
And to me, that does seem to be what's behind the concept of a very amphibious Australian army. That, you know, we're going to give the army anti-ship missiles and we're going to set them up across, you know, the island chain to our north.
To get sneaky and dangerous.
And stop the bad guys sailing through. So those Chinese maritime task force that, you know, showed up off East Coast Australia while in war with Singapore.
They won't even get here, my friend.
They won't even get here. And you sort of go, okay, yeah, I can see the concept, but it is, in a sense, I've always thought, if that's your concept, you have kind of granted or conceded sort of the initiative to the bad guys already. You know, we're going to sit behind our Maginot line of anti-ship missiles and wait for the bad guys to come
well,
to us.
Well, you know, you're getting back to, so what are we actually doing with a big exercise like Talisman Sabre? You know, it's US, Australia, and I think 17 other nations. And before we started recording, you made the point that when you hear people actually at the exercise and they're talking with journalists who've been flown up, it all sounds very much like, this is just what we do. This is 2 years on from the last one. We're proving interoperability. We're trusted partners. We're close. We're sending a strong message about how closely we can work together. We're bringing in more partners to work out how they can work together. This is a resolute demonstration of military capability. Meanwhile, back in the capitals of these partners, like Washington, London, Canberra, there's trouble at the mill. But in Talisman Sabre land, it's like it's 5 years ago.
Well, it is sort of, on the one hand, it's sort of reassuring that, you know, on the ground, all of our militaries are working together. They're increasing that interoperability. You know, we're developing trust. We know how we all work. More people want to come and play.
You're in the second century of mateship.
Yeah, and, you know, more people want to play Talisman Sabre than ever before. And the UK sent out an aircraft carrier. What was it? First visit since 1827
I was going to just, like the UK, trouble at the mill in London. The UK government has just announced a fundamental priority, NATO first, for their military. In their review where they've said The UK military is hollowed out. It's had decades of being hollowed out, now needs to be rebuilt, but rebuilt with a very clear-eyed NATO-first focus. Now, that's a complete contradiction to the previous policy, which was Europe's important, but we're doing an Indo-Pacific shift because, you know, what's happening in the Indo-Pacific is of global importance.
They're doing the opposite of the US. I mean, the US has been talking about refocus on the Indo-Pacific, you know, sort of incrementally been getting there, but the UK is sort of doing the opposite.
Well, partly because the US is shifting away from Europe, so the UK has got to get more relentless about focusing on Europe. So if they're rebuilding a hollowed out military and they've got to have a relentless focus on NATO first, they don't have the means or capacity to focus on the Indo-Pacific like they told us they were going to. The fact that this UK aircraft carrier is the first one to visit since 1997, which I think is 28 years ago.
That would make sense.
That the four ministers, the Orkmin ministers, celebrated this as magnificent. I think that just demonstrates the point that the UK is not an Indo-Pacific power.
Well, it also, I think, indicates the extent to which the UK's military power has declined. So first of all, it could only deploy that aircraft carrier out here supported by a bunch of other NATO countries. So there's other
European countries have
had to provide escorts for it and logistics ships for it. So the UK doesn't have the self-reliant ability to do that anymore. Secondly, they don't have enough F-35Bs, so the short takeoff vertical landing version of the Joint Strike Fighter, to provide it with a full complement. So it has to be topped up by US Marine Corps F-35B. So again, the UK is reliant on others just to make that one aircraft carrier
work.
Well,
it needs the interoperability to make that carrier work. And isn't it true, you were telling me, part of this UK government announcement about their NATO first shift has resulted in more F-35s being bought, but there's a but there.
Yes. So again, you know, I'm relying on media, you know, and as we know from Donald Trump, you can't trust everything you read.
Could be fake news.
It could be fake news, particularly if they're reporting on Donald Trump, but that's a separate issue. The UK has decided, well, it wants to maintain, there is a program under which European allies maintain the ability to deliver US nuclear bombs. So everybody has skin in the game. Mm. So everybody has the capability.
It's a share in extended deterrence, isn't it?
Yes.
Like the Germans have had that.
Yes. Unfortunately, the only aircraft the UK can get to maintain that ability is the F-35. So the conventional takeoff version, the one we've got, which has longer range than the F-35B. So they've had to cut their F-35B order, so the ones that are going to go on their aircraft carrier, so they can buy a vanishingly small fleet of 12 F-35As so they can maintain that nuclear strike capability. So again, it just sort of shows that when you're trying to operate on 2 and a bit, even 2.5 perhaps, percent of GDP, you sort of spread your spending
choices
so wide. You end up with vanishingly small quantities of a large range of things.
Well,
you have no mass, and you just, so you've got these
fragile
two aircraft carriers, you don't have enough planes to operate them properly.
Yeah. And the F-35A purchase, about contributing to extended deterrence in the nuclear realm in Europe, is another manifestation of their actual priority, NATO first.
Yes.
So you know, I then, this has got us right onto the Australia-UK AUKUS Treaty, the Geelong Treaty, I hear it's being called, after Mr. Miles Electric. His mum must be very proud.
Went to Geelong Grammar as well. So,
maybe it was
deep roots in Geelong.
Could it have been signed on the grounds of Geelong Grammar? I can see a board with Richard Miles' name on it going up there.
Who else went to Geelong Grammar?
Not me.
No, the King.
The King.
Our King.
Oh, gosh. I hope it was signed on the grounds then. Good old King Charles. When this UK-Australia AUKUS treaty was announced by the ministers before they signed it, it was reported as in some strange ways. Like one way, a bunch of journalists were saying to me, oh, Michael, this looks like a plan B for AUKUS if the Americans actually pull out. Is that true?
No, it is part and parcel of Plan A.
Yeah, I said
it is just the slow incremental rollout of Plan A.
It's an implementing piece of paper. But yes, I think signing it, getting it out, talking breathlessly about a 50-year treaty and how determined this shows Australia and the UK are, I think that is part of the symbolic campaign to say to Washington, you know, two of the three partners are all in. So Colby, please notice that we're all in and don't leave us alone.
But the most interesting bit, I think, is when the UK ministers kind of really couldn't control themselves and went, well, this means 20 billion pounds, so 40 million Aussie, billion Aussie dollars will flow to the UK.
Jobs. It's funny, I thought the UK ministers, maybe they needed the High Commissioner here, the UK High Commissioner, to say, hey, that's your inside voice, you know, yes, about how the Australians are funneling billions of dollars into the UK economy and it's about jobs, jobs, jobs. But they couldn't help themselves, could they? It's like when the French won a previous submarine contract. It was the contract of the century.
Gosh, so long ago now, Michael.
Same thing. They were celebrating rivers of Australian cash. Yeah. One thing I will say about this idea of jobs, jobs, jobs and $40 billion of money going from Australia into the UK economy. Nuclear submarines create a vibrant, high-technology economy. Why is it that the town in the UK that has been making the UK's nuclear submarines since the 1950s, Barrow-in-Furness, is a depressed, struggling Northern England town and not the UK's Silicon Valley, which actually grew later than that?
Well, there's a number of reasons for that. One of them is that people don't actually want to live in Barrow-in-Furness if you are part of the new economy. And I remember I was at a conference recently and there was a speaker from one of the companies involved in the UK's nuclear submarine program, and he said, actually, you got to put the work where the workers are. The workers aren't going to come to the work. You got to take the work to the workers. So all of their high tech stuff is not actually in Barrow-in-Furness because people don't want to live there.
You got to carry large chunks of steel to the outer suburbs of London, have you?
This was more the IT side.
The sneaky electron stuff.
Yes, yeah. But it does get back to that fundamental issue of defence spending. I'm sorry, as somebody who is a big fan of defence spending and, you know, has a relationship with a defence company here in Australia, defence spending does not grow the economy. It just does not. If it did, why do we have to drag governments kicking and screaming over the 2% kind of benchmark? Well, because they know it doesn't generate economic growth. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, if it did, why the USSR would be ruling the world?
That's right. Why was Ronald Reagan so smart and bankrupted the USSR by outspending them on defense, thus sending the Soviet economy bankrupt? Well, I think it's because the Soviets didn't have a cashed up partner to rescue them like the UK has us Australians. That's it. I mean, if only Gorbachev had been able to sign a USSR Australia submarine deal, maybe the USSR never would have gone bankrupt.
I'm not too sure about that.
Jobs, jobs, jobs.
We may have to blank this bit out because I just totally spaced. Oh, sorry. Yes. Yeah, but getting back to this earlier point about Talisman Sabre, there seems to be this disjuncture between this kind of business as usual on the ground, which is probably a good thing. You know, you want your militaries to keep working together. But in the capitals, you've got this very different situation of, well, who knows what's going on in Washington, D.C. and the churn in the Pentagon and, you know, Trump essentially declaring trade wars on longstanding allies. You've got that. We look at the position of the US, the Australian government, and we looked at Penny Wong's speech and Prime Minister Albanese's statements on our security situation.
And he's been cheered on by some business interests that are up to their neck in Chinese economic engagement. So, yeah.
It's kind of, I think, quite incoherent where they sort of seem to be saying US power has guaranteed our security for so long and our prosperity for so long. But then there's this sort of nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Things are different in the US now. But then we want to uphold the rules-based global order. And gosh, aren't things great with China? And we just need to, you know, have mutual respect for China, even though our own travel advice says, be careful traveling to China because you could be locked up for no reason.
Exercise extreme caution because you're subject to arbitrary detention and arrest.
Yes. And this US military power that has maintained our security may be faltering and the US is asking for help and allies to spend more, but we're not going to spend more money. We're not going to go beyond 2%.
We're a proud independent nation.
So and we've got it's all of this incoherence at the sort of in the capitals. And I was reading this interesting piece by Peter Varghese, former Secretary of DFAT.
Well, not just former Secretary of DFAT, he was the head of the Office of National Assessment before it became the Office of National Intelligence.
And you might recall Michael, that one of the grumpiest things
Mr. Varghese to you.
One of the grumpiest things I've written in the last year or so was a assessment of Mr. Varghese's report, his review of funding for the Australian national security community. And basically, I wrote a very grumpy piece saying he'd missed the point completely. Ooh. It was kind of this piece that what you would expect out of a former Mandarin that basically says we should let the Mandarins sort of manage the whole national security community. We don't want to just hand out money people to come up with their own ideas.
But it was incredible that someone who had headed up the intelligence assessment agency, the peak intelligence assessment agency that reports to the Prime Minister, could say that actually alternative advice, vibrant alternative advice to ministers that is an alternative to advice provided by departments headed by secretaries is best provided by giving the control of the alternative advice to a group of secretaries. And the fact that a former head of ONA could say that was breathtaking. The fact that a former Secretary of Foreign Affairs could say that was absolutely to be expected.
Yes. So I'm not, you know, averse to criticising Mr. Varghese when I think he's got it wrong. So, but what is here is, I think, quite interesting piece. It was in the Australian Financial Review recently. It has a rather inflammatory headline that I think a sub-editor must have put top there saying, yep. I ran DFAT, I hope Elbridge Colby sinks AUKUS for Australia. Now, I don't think Mr. Varghese is a big fan of AUKUS, but the piece isn't primarily about sinking AUKUS. But I think he makes some very clear kind of statements that we tend to lose sight of. And his view is that, you know, Mr. Trump's naked transactionalism is a salutary reminder that the US, like all countries, will only ever act in its own interests, and that does not include guaranteeing the security of an ally in all circumstances.
At the moment, you just gave me a horrible image of a naked Donald Trump engaging in transactionalism. But I think that point about national self-interest has come through loud and clear out of Washington. Yeah.
Yes. And what I find kind of interesting is that our mandarins, you know, the sort of the wise old grey heads, split quite differently.
Yes. There's a Mandarin schism.
Yes. You know, and so people like Dennis Richardson are all in on AUKUS. And
People like Dennis Richardson? Oh, no, I see what you're saying. Yes. Keep going.
It's like, you just got to make it work. You just got to make it work.
It's un-Australian.
And we need it. Mr. Varghese, well, he's a bit sort of doesn't seem to think AUKUS is a good thing, but he is very clearly saying we need greater defence self-reliance.
Doesn't he say, why doesn't he think AUKUS is a good idea? What's in that article then?
Well, it is the point that we have raised many times, Michael, and that is, I'll quote, nuclear submarines distort both the cost and focus of the force structure.
That's absolutely true.
It is absolutely.
Look at $3.5 billion going into AUKUS this year and a little tiny drip feed going into drone and counter-drone technology.
Yeah. So he says, defence self-reliance has not come cheap. It will require a significant uplift in our defence budget, not to meet some arbitrary percentage of gross domestic product, but to fund the force structure that we need for the defence of Australia. Mm-hmm. Now, again, this is a point we've been making, but it is completely contrary to the government's position.
Yes.
So, because it seems, again, to want this kind of weird magic pudding land of we can have AUKUS, we can have this great new improved force structure, but we don't really need to increase defence spending.
Well, and we can get in good in an even bigger way with those folk running China in Beijing. Mm-hmm. So it's... There are many contradictions in the current trajectories in Australian defence and economic policy.
So I'm sort of just raising this, not basically to kind of get back at this view that, well, that we're seeing coming out of the AUKUS grifter crowd, that if you oppose AUKUS, you're disloyal. You know, you're disloyal to Australia, you're disloyal to the alliance, and so just get on board.
We only have fear itself to fear.
But here we have a sort of pillar of the national security community, this former Mandarin, sort of calling out the incoherence of the government's current policy and calling out the basic fact that you cannot afford AUKUS on 2% of GDP.
Well, but that sort of reality-based view of the world, I think, gets in the way of the beauty in some of the UK-Australian ministerial pronouncements, like the joint AUKMIN statement, which is mainly, it's like I felt I was at a music recital. It's full of so many reconfirms, restate, recites, very old-fashioned communique. But it's got the wonderful news, and it's welcomed by Ms. Wong and Mr. Miles, that the UK is going to get 12 attack nuclear submarines. And they're going to expand production, and they're going to build them even faster. They're going to build a submarine every 18 months. And it's stated as if that's just all already happening.
It is. They're going to be here. So this was an announcement that was in there. Defence Strategic Review of Defence Strategy.
We've talked about it before.
Defence Review, that's it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's a review that's strategic and it's about defence.
And 12, the number, Michael, the number is no longer 7.
It shall not be 7, nor shall it be 8 or 9. The number is 12.
It should be 12. 12 shall be the number. Now, just to refresh our readers' memories, how many SSNs does the UK currently have at sea at the moment?
Well, that isn't 12.
No, I think it's a number more than negative 1 and less than 1.
If you took the average of negative 1 and 1, you would get the number. The number is 0.
The number
they have
is 0.
No attack submarines at sea again. The last one just got back and none. Yeah, so the idea even that there'll be this frequent rotational presence of one UK submarine off Stirling in Western Australia, I think that's magical thinking. But the idea
that they go saying it'll be off Stirling, implying it'll be at sea. Maybe it'll just be at Stirling.
Well, if it got there, it may never leave. I just think that the amount of magical thinking in this communique about AUKUS and the UK's own ability to produce submarines is extraordinary. But it's received as a congratulations. You know, the fact they said they were going to build one every 18 months, the fact that actually what AUKUS allied Michael, submarine production has gone backwards, not forwards.
So, Michael, as you know, if you don't have a dream, how are you ever going to have a dream come true? So you got to have your dream. Now, speaking of dreams, I thought, and on ground truthing, we're coming up, we're getting close to the four-year anniversary of the AUKUS announcement.
Ooh, yep.
And as we know, a key part of the AUKUS announcement is that Australia will get its first SSN handed over from the US Navy in 2032. That is the current...
That's the optimal
pathway. Optimal pathway, yep. Or plan A.
Yep.
How are we doing? So I've actually compared the US defense budget for FY22. So that would have been the budget sort of around in 2021 when AUKUS was announced.
Yep.
Compare it 4 years on with FY2026. So how is delivery tracking?
Well, there's been billions of dollars of reinvestment by the US in its submarine industrial base over that time, and in fact before then. COVID's a while ago now, so I'd say they must have upped their production rate now. They were at 1.2. Well, I know there's the little wobble where they went back to 1.1.
Let's look at delivery dates. In FY2022, so on the eve of AUKUS, SSN 802. So that was in production. It was meant to be delivered right now, June 2025.
Right, yeah.
Okay. Do you know when it is actually going to be delivered, Michael? Bit of a Dorothy Dixie.
Well, I don't think we can be certain.
Well,
according, is it currently planned?
According to the US budget documentation...
For this year?
Yes. Ooh. It is now June 2028. So it's around 3 years later.
So since AUKUS was agreed, delivery has gone backwards.
Forwards into the future. Yeah. Depends how you define it. It has slowed down. Yeah. Now, if we go and look at SSN 809, that was sort of the most recent one to go into contract at the time the FY2022 budget had been released. And they were aiming then for it to be delivered in May 2029. Okay. The date now is April 2032.
3 years.
3 years. So, and if we look across all of the US submarines, that's about the order of magnitude. So a 3 year slippage. So we have said a number of times that by 2032, there will not be any more SSN in existence under the AUKUS plan than there were
before
the AUKUS plan. In fact, what we're seeing is there will be less submarines in existence in 2032.
Than the US plan itself before AUKUS.
Yes. So not only is the US numbers of US Navy's planned submarine numbers sort of going backwards because of these 3 years delays, but there's not additional submarines to compensate for them providing us with any submarines.
Yeah. So contrast those actual budget documents with delivery dates of submarines with the breathless celebration from the Australian and UK ministers. And this is why when people say you just got to believe in AUKUS and doubts are so un-Australian, I think they really need to ground themselves in some more objective information about what's actually happening, because that eventually matters.
Well, I don't know. I mean, Mr. Miles did hand over the second suitcase of cash, so another $800 million going into the US submarine industrial base. Maybe will turn it around.
It won't. It won't, because the US production is in much better shape than the UK production, and at least the US hasn't engaged in magical thinking by asserting they're going to double their production rate.
Well, we reviewed some of the numbers in a recent podcast.
Yeah, it wasn't like, doubling. They've got to go up by 400%.
Yeah, they're sort of quadrupling or quintupling the amount of submarine tons they need to pump through the production line every year. So it's a big ask.
Yeah. Well, anyway, between Talisman Sabre, historic Geelong treaties backed by magical thinking, and some very gilded drone lilies, it's been an interesting episode, and I think it's right to send you off now to cycle around Samoa and collect some further ground.
I'll come back and with lots of information on the state of, I'm not quite sure what, hopefully coral reefs in Samoa, but there may be something of some strategic interest there.
Well, you can find out how that South Pacific rugby funding initiative is going. I think, you know, we've got to stop funding just league and get into union as well now.
Yep. Okay.
Anyway, good to talk with you, Marcus.
You too, Michael.
A quick correction. Quantum Systems, although it's got a regional hub in Brisbane for assembling the Vector UAV, is actually a German company, not an Australian company. Thanks to one of our listeners for correcting that.